The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
These are the front lines of a new immigration crackdown in America. Federal officers from ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, on their way to arrest some of the millions of immigrants who are in the country illegally.
First target, guys.
A favorite place of European vacationers is Lampedusa. It's a very tiny island with warm breezes and sparkling blue waters, located in the Mediterranean Ocean, midway between Libya and Sicily. Lampedusa is also a place where refugees from war and famine, victims of human trafficking, and people simply looking for a better life come ashore after days at sea in small craft.
Bulldozers move swiftly through the makeshift homes, demolishing the aluminium and cardboard structures with ease. This camp in the Greek port of Patras has been home to tens of hundreds of migrants since it was first set up 12 years ago.
I think immigrant experiences, you know, being a foreigner can be in some ways a very isolating experience. One feels very alone. But I think when you look back, when you step back and sort of look at the world, you see how many people are moving around, have moved around, have shifted, have been displaced both by choice or by necessity. It's more common in a way to be approaching life with these questions, with these issues, with these challenges than not.
Migration has been a big theme in the books longlisted for this year's Man Booker Prize. And not just the move to the wealthy environments of Europe or the US. Recently on this podcast, you heard one of the authors, Tash Orr, following economic migrants from his homeland of Malaysia to Shanghai in China. On the other hand, Jhumpa Lahiri, who you've just heard speaking to the Guardian Book Club, writes about bright Bengalis heading to New England in the US. She's already won the Pulitzer Prize, and her second novel, The Lowland, is on the Man Booker shortlist. She says she's absolutely thrilled.
London is where I began, literally. It was where I was born and more generally where my family's life really began outside of India. I imagine for many immigrant families, certainly for mine, the family really is reborn in a fundamental sense in the new territory. And for my family, that journey began in London nearly 50 years ago when my father came. He came in 1964. And we have been very closely connected to London and to England ever since because of those years that my mother and father spent here and because they were the first years of their lives abroad. And so much of that experience has informed me, the person I am, and then subsequently my work. I feel like it's all come out of that experience of their having left their country and creating a family, a sense of history, you know, all over again. So, you know, the Man Booker has a global significance in my mind, you know, connecting writers from so many parts of the world.
There's an irony here, a little bit of an irony for us, who've been very embroiled in the controversy of whether the Booker should admit Americans, that here you are, you're an American national.
I'm actually a British and American national.
A British and American national. But you're in, you may be the very last entrant of the pre-American era of the Booker Prize. How does that feel to you? You really are a child of many worlds.
Well, it's strange because I never thought of myself as American. That's the irony. For most of my life, I was told not to be American and that I wasn't American, both by my parents and also by Americans themselves, who regarded me as a foreigner and I wasn't born there and I was aware of that. I remember coming to, we came to London quite often as when I was growing up. We were here twice when I was growing up for a few months at a time. And I remember wanting, hoping, expecting somehow that here, because I was born here, that there would be some belonging because I didn't feel it, some sense of belonging because I was never feeling it in America. And of course, here I realized I didn't belong either because we didn't live here anymore. I remember though once when I was young, a young girl, and coming into Heathrow and somebody opened up my passport and simply because it said London, England as my birthplace, he said, "Oh, welcome home." And it was so meaningful to me as a young girl to hear that. I never heard that anywhere else, you know, not even when we went to India.
Let's talk a little bit about how this experience has gone into your novel, which isn't directly autobiographical, although it has autobiographical details, such as where your main character migrates to is Rhode Island, where your father took you as a young family. And they come from Calcutta, where your family came from.
The locations are places that I know. The part of Calcutta where the novel opens is the neighborhood where my father grew up, the neighborhood of Tollygunge, where I spent a lot of time as a young girl on visits to India, to Calcutta. And then, yes, as you say, Rhode Island is where my parents moved in 1970 when I was 3 years old, and they continue to live there. And it's the first time in my writing, in my fiction writing, that I decided to set a book in Rhode Island. But apart from the locations, the story is really invented. The inspiration for it is an actual incident, an execution that I learned about that took place just steps from where my paternal grandparents lived in 71 during the repression of the Naxalite movement. Two brothers who lived in the neighborhood where my father grew up were killed in front of their parents and other family members by the paramilitary during the repression of this movement. And I heard about this. It was something that struck me, upset me, confused me, made me feel very ignorant. To know a place in some way and yet to really not know it. It's the conjunction of those two realities, the sort of the sense of ignorance and also the sense of familiarity. This drew me to that world and to that incident and a curiosity more than anything, wanting to understand, well, why were these two brothers killed? Who were they? What were they doing? And when I never knew them, I don't know the family. I have absolutely no connection with them. They just remain figures to me. And so the characters I began to build bear no relationship at all to these actual brothers.
Nevertheless, you do have a real, one of the characters who's referred to a lot is Kanu Sanyal, who was a Naxalite, which was a Maoist movement. And he only actually committed suicide in 2010. So you're dealing with real history as well as with this great fictional story of dynastic story in a way.
So many of the people who were involved in the movement are still alive. I mean, those who weren't killed, everyone over a certain age in Calcutta has lived that time, has a story to tell, usually more than one story to tell about something, some incident, some raid, some friend, some brother, someone who, you know, some meeting. I mean, it's still very present. My family members would talk about it, my extended family. I myself had extended family members involved in the movement. I knew about this. My great aunts and uncles would talk about this. My grandmother would write letters to my mother saying, you know, describing what was happening in the neighborhood and the fear people felt and the worry for the students at the time. I never get close to them as a writer. I mean, they exist in the book. They do things in the book. I hope I've portrayed what they do and say accurately, but I never fictionalize them. I mean, certainly writers can take a historical figure and really inhabit them in a way. I chose not to do that. I was more focused on the characters I invented and used the historical and political element of the book more as a catalyst and also a kind of a backdrop for the story.
Now, in your book, only one of the brothers gets killed, and Subhash comes to America, and he not only goes to America, but he marries his brother's widow. And you do something very interesting with language there. Well, Bengali they speak between them becomes a language of concealment rather than of truth, because their daughter doesn't speak that language. Therefore, they can conceal the bad things that are happening in their marriage and their relationship.
I spoke only Bengali until I was of school age. But my parents also had a very, very rich social life with other Bengali immigrants in the United States. And so it wasn't just the language my mother and father spoke, but rather it was a language that I spoke at home day to day with them, but then every weekend we would go to some friend's house and there would be 10 or 15 other families there. And it was, even though it was limited and isolated as a language, I was hearing it from, you know, so many sources over time. And I think that enriched my understanding of the language. I think in Bella's case, the daughter in this book, her parents lead a very socially isolated life, and the Bengali that exists, it really exists only between them, and their marriage itself is strained, and they are estranged from one another. So I imagine that the child's understanding of the language would be somewhat limited.
You said in an interview in the New York Times that all American literature is, in a sense, immigrant literature.
Well, I mean, I think that that is the definition of the United States. It's a country founded on immigrants, people coming from elsewhere, setting down roots and becoming American, which is, I mean, in a way, America is unique among countries in that it is a place in which everyone, apart from the native population, has had to become American and to adopt that country from the original English immigrants. And that has been a continuous process. And I think at this point, it becomes relative. You know, and people think of Puritans as the original Americans, but of course they weren't. You know, they came from England. You know, it's a deracinated people who then have a second life and a second seating, as it were, in a new territory.
You live now in Rome. How different is your experience of European, being an outsider, an American in Rome, as opposed to being an English person or a Bengali in America?
It's interesting. I mean, I love living there. I feel very connected to the city. I love the language. In a way, I feel very at home there. Europe has its own conceptions, preconceptions, and misconceptions. People don't really think of me as American there, partly because of my appearance, my name, what have you. I don't fit into the standard model of an American for many Italians. They tend to assume that I'm from India, that I was raised in India. In Italy, the issue of immigration is very charged. The definition of what is Italian is, in my view, very narrow still. I mean, there are many immigrants in Italy, and it interests me to observe, to witness what is happening with immigrants and what and how Italians are accommodating or not accommodating these changes. Again, I've never been able to feel fully American anywhere I go, but it's interesting to see how that changes. I mean, maybe in the UK I'm perceived as more American than anywhere else. I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Jhumpa Lahiri. The Lowland is published by Bloomsbury. Debut novelist No Violet Bulawayo is the first Zimbabwean to get onto the Man Booker shortlist. And her novel takes the same route to Kalamazoo in the US as she did. The story centres on a group of children whose parents have been forced into poverty for opposing Robert Mugabe. The heroine eventually escapes her country, but does not find happiness in America. The name No Violet Bulawayo is a made-up one, appropriately enough for the author of a novel called We Need New Names. Her real name is Elizabeth Chele. She met up with our Africa correspondent, David Smith, in South Africa, and explained why she had adopted the name of the town where she grew up.
I felt this heavy sense of nostalgia and just wanting to identify with the homeland. I mean, I come from a place of colourful names. I was telling you about Extra Blessing.
Yes.
So besides Extra Blessing, I don't see my name as For me, it was just personal reasons, just connecting with my mother, you know. It has a lot to do with identity, and identity is a big part of my creative process too, you know. So I needed a meaningful identity that could carry the weight of whatever I'm doing, you know.
How old are you now?
31.
And how old were you when you left?
18.
Did that feel like a wrench at the time, or was it more about this is going to be a big adventure?
Big adventure. I mean, you're 18, you're carefree. I wasn't thinking ahead. I wasn't thinking about anything except living. Of course, the reality started sinking in once I got there.
Can you remember arriving in America for the first time? What was the sensation?
For the first time, flew into Detroit Airport, you know, nothing glamorous, really. I was like, okay, where is the flashiness? Yeah. And then the cold, too. It was quite brutal to the system.
How much time passed before you eventually went back to Zimbabwe? Did you say 13 years?
13 years, yes. I just went this April, actually.
Oh, that just was the first
decided,
time in April.
Yeah, yeah, just decided to pack my bags. Nobody knew I was coming, you know, except my high school friend who was picking me up from the airport.
Why did you make that decision?
Because I'd promised to come before and I didn't show up, either because I couldn't afford it at that time or it just wasn't the right time. So I just missed home and decided to show up.
And how did the Zimbabwe in 2013 compare with the one you remembered?
It was a strange country, you know. I went there in search for the Zimbabwe I knew, and it was a shock, you know. Power cuts, water cuts, just driving down the streets, the potholes were amazing, and 80% of the population not working. Just seeing the desperation, you know, you go to the shops, wherever you went, people were struggling. So that was a picture of the country that I never knew. I was split because on one hand, I was happy to be home and seeing my father. I mean, he's 74 and his health was acting up at that time, seeing my siblings. But at the same time, I felt so lost, you know, because I couldn't relate to anything. I couldn't understand anything. I felt like the country had changed the people, and I just felt like an outsider in my own home. So I would be having conversations, and I'd just tune out. And yet people didn't also realize what was happening, that, okay, I was home, but I was also lost, you know.
When you left for America, were you doing that on your own or with other family members?
I just left by myself. Of course, I had a bigger sister there and my aunt and a few cousins.
That must have been a big decision, a wrench. Did your father try and talk you out of it?
No, it wasn't my decision. It was my father's decision. I mean, I come from a culture where children are children. You get told that, okay, you have finished high school, you're applying for this, and, you know, so that's how it went. I don't ever remember making the decision that, okay, I want to leave. And it was made for me. But I'm good with it, obviously.
I'm sorry, remind me, who was waiting in Michigan? Was it your
aunt? Was my aunt and another cousin I'd never met. She had left when I was, you know, when I was young. She is a retired nurse. She's been there for like forever, for 40, more than 40 years. Yeah.
Why do you think Zimbabwe has changed so much in that 13 years?
Because things aren't working. Things fell apart, you know. Political mismanagement.
What do you think of President Mugabe?
It's not a black and white issue. I mean, there was a time when it was good for the country, but I feel like that time is gone. And I feel like we need a new breed of leadership, you know, not just a presidential figure, but just a new gang. And for me, I think the answers lies with young people, because I feel like the current leadership is old, is outdated, and it has failed the people. I mean, the government has been in power for just before I was born, and I think it's just time to give the ball to better players. And I feel like Zimbabweans are capable enough, you know. Young people are broad educated, they've lived in places, are aware of working systems, of doing things. And the reality is that they don't have a voice, you know.
Do you think Mugabe was a good man who was sort of corrupted somehow? I mean, was there a moment that he turned?
I think there was a moment. I mean, the last election spoke to it all. Obviously, I think a balanced person would be hard pressed to just stand and say this guy is a good guy, you know, with all the facts on the table. And it's quite sad that a country with so much promise is just forced on its knees because of the ruling party.
Some people in Africa still regard Mugabe yeah. is a bit of a liberation hero. Is there?
I think it's easy to have that perspective from a distance, you know. If you haven't directly suffered, if you haven't directly felt the brunt of his person and his role, it's easy. You know, even in the States, people actually hail him as one of Africa's leading statesmen. But the reality is that the people on the ground have a different story, and that's who I'm concerned about. That's part of why I wrote the book, you know. My generation is known as the born-free generation. We really don't buy this stance against the West because we are aware of our problems, and our problems are really specifically homegrown, you know. I feel like it's a distraction, you know. It's time people faced up to who and what is our problem. The election wasn't stolen up by the West. Violence of 2008 wasn't carried out by the West, you know. The beauty of what I do is all about educating people. I feel like any time somebody picks up, we need new names, it becomes an eye-opening and a learning experience.
Could you talk a bit about the title of the book, sort of why you chose this and what it's trying to convey?
We need new names. It came from a time when, you know, just looking at our identity as Zimbabweans, it wants to speak to the need for new ways of seeing ourselves, the need for new leadership, the need of new ideas, you know. It's a very, very deliberate title that tried to capture the wrongs of the time that inspired it. So seeing the country come undone, you know, it just was crazy. I remember I just had a hard time. I was still in school, and one of my professors was like, why don't you just write about it, you know? And so I wrote for catharsis. And then as I wrote, it also, and, you know, sharing, I was also blogging at the time and sharing with Zimbabweans and seeing how people were starting to be invested in the narrative. Some of the things I was writing, it became a national project. I wrote with the consciousness of what literature can do for a people, you know.
And what kind of response have you had from Zimbabweans?
It's been wonderful. I think part of it is because it comes from a very urgent space. It comes from a time that shook us all, so that when people are reading, they connect to that time, it hurts them, it's emotionally charged. And I just came from home, from doing a launch at home, and I was just humbled by how much people just came and also bought books, you know. It was also hard to tell people that I write because, you know, people would think, well, anybody can pick up a pen and write.
Do you mean people anywhere or particularly in Zimbabwe?
No, family. Family. Right. I mean, I also didn't want to
be a doctor or lawyer or something.
Yeah. That's why I left the States to be a lawyer, you know. And growing up, I didn't even want to be a writer. I didn't have any writing aspirations because for me, that wasn't a meaningful career, you know. So, I had to deal with that growing up. So having my father come to the launch and see what I did, it was
fantastic.
It was just wonderful. Yeah.
What are your future plans? You're at Stanford University at the moment.
I'm at Stanford finishing in a year, and I just want to write full-time for a minute. Yeah.
You're saying you quite like to leave America and move somewhere else?
Yeah, just get out, at least split my time between the US and Africa somewhere. Yeah, looking for a place that speaks to me, you know. Yeah, that allows me to create and do something meaningful.
What is your sort of happiest childhood memory from Zimbabwe?
Stealing fruits, guavas, and friendships, childhood friendships.
A lost world sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah, it is a lost world. It is a lost world, yeah.
No Violet Bulawayo, and Stealing Fruit is how her book begins. We Need New Names is published by Chatto and Windus. Of course, migration is not only a major issue in literature, but in politics and economics too. Paul Collier, an economics professor based at Oxford University, has taken on this highly contentious debate in his new book, Exodus, Immigration and Multiculturalism in the 21st Century. For instance, he told Richard Lee that most economists think migration is so beneficial to the world economy that it's the nearest thing it has to a free lunch.
The countries I work on in Africa, maybe per capita income is $1,000 a year. That means somebody's working for a whole year and producing $1,000. And they come to Europe or North America, and if they're the average bod, they probably earn about $25,000, meaning they're producing at least that. So that's probably a bit exaggerated, but the benchmark would be something like a tenfold increase in productivity. That's what gets economists salivating at the mouth. They say this is a free lunch.
So what are the forces which are driving migration to accelerate in the 21st century?
This is a key building block in the book, that if you just don't intervene, migration accelerates. Because migration is a very costly process for poor people. And how do they get those costs down if they've got a relative who's already there? And so if we start migration in sort of 1955, when there aren't any diasporas, it's very hard to migrate. There's nobody there to receive you.
There's an upfront cost.
There's a big upfront cost. And so migrants are typically not amongst the poor. They're, in effect, the middle classes, because they can afford to finance the investment in getting out. But as the diasporas build up, it gets easier and easier to finance. People are there to lower the costs once you're there. They've got a network of information. They can send money for the ticket. And so migration accelerates, because the income gap tempting people along stays pretty well the same.
But this global free lunch comes at some sort of cost to host societies, doesn't it? It's not because of the effect of migration on wages, which you argue is much smaller than many think. It's more because of the social costs. What do these social costs involve?
So there are social benefits and there are social costs. Some migration is better than no migration because you get some benefits. You get innovation, you get variety, all the things that make a society more fun, more vibrant, more innovative. But you can have too much diversity as well as too little. In Africa, I'm sorry, this has been old hat for years, because African societies are far more diverse than European or North American societies. Boy, do they pay for that diversity. So there are three big costs of diversity. One is lower levels of trust. You've got a more fragmented, atomized society, and people don't trust each other as much. Now, the highest trust society in the world is kind of Japan, highly homogeneous. At the other end of the spectrum are societies like Nigeria, very low trust. And that then rebounds on the cost of doing transactions. Second cost is cooperation. It's much harder to get the cooperation needed to provide public goods. And the final cost is generosity. A diverse society is less generous to its poor. That's why I think America is much weaker welfare systems, despite being richer, than the typical European country.
Because it's a society founded on migration.
It's got a lot of diversity, and people just have less sense of social glue, what I call mutual regard. Hmm.
Despite the obvious economic benefits for migrants themselves, there are other costs which migrants, and indeed the societies they leave behind, have to bear.
Just like in host countries, migration is a two-edged sword. Some migration's better than none, but you can have too much as well as too little. A society like China or India really benefits from migration. The big countries benefit because proportionately not many people migrate. They get a small outflow, and those people then go back. The Indians who went to Silicon Valley, picked up skills, went back. Fantastic. They founded a whole software industry, which is now huge. Students coming to Europe and America, they get skills, they change attitudes, and they go back, and that, we can establish, is hugely beneficial. But you can have too much. Haiti, where I've been working on, 85% of educated young Haitians leave. They're hemorrhaging the bright, young, educated people who would otherwise be there to build a society out of poverty. And when you get that sort of rate of emigration, it's debilitating. You can never get started.
So if rapidly accelerating migration is bad for host countries, what's your prescription for stopping it?
There's a lot of moral energy going into criticising the fact that we've got controls, and that is utterly misplaced. Of course we need controls, but we need controls that are designed to some purpose rather than driven by the tabloid leaders, which is what we've got at the moment. So just to give you one example, we know that bringing students from poor countries who then get trained, get familiarized with modern society and go back is hugely beneficial for poor societies. It's hugely beneficial for us. It's our 21st century export industry. And when bright young people go back with a British education, they stay connected to Britain. They become the network that British business can then build on.
You also suggest that rights to bring across dependents should be restricted by proportion.
If we have some overall ceiling on migrants, then the more dependents we let in, the fewer others can come in. The fewer skilled workers, the fewer people who are going to come, get training, work for a while, go back, that sort of thing.
The dependents will just crowd those others out.
Exactly. And the other reason, paradoxically, is the effect on the people left behind in poor societies. If a guy who's come to Britain and made it can bring his relatives in, he cuts his remittances back home.
You suggest that, I mean, similarly, rights to social housing should also be given in proportion to the size of the diaspora. But questions of identity are much more complicated than a simple number, aren't they? How do you tell who's part of a diaspora, who's part of a migrant group, and who's part of society, who's already assimilated?
Yeah, the concern there is just so that we don't get a head-to-head contest between the indigenous poor and immigrants. That's brutal, and that is the feeding ground of resentment. At the moment, we have, in an ad hoc sort of way, policies like I suggest, but they're chosen just by this local authority does this, that local authority does that. It's the policies about which we do not speak. Mm. That is not a way to run a modern society. We need to be open about the problems and discuss them openly. Until we've got the concept of diasporas and their rate of absorption, we can't begin to measure, and measurement will follow. As an army of sociologists in Britain who'll be only too happy to measure. And so if we get going now in 5-10 years' time, we'll have the numbers to answer your question.
This issue is shot through with different levels of analysis, where the interests of groups at one level, the individual, the family, or whatever, conflict with the interests of groups at another, the level of the community or the nation. This year, half of the novels on the Booker shortlist are about geographical dislocation or migration, straightforwardly. And are these competing interests at different levels one of the reasons why migration is such a fertile subject for fiction?
I think so. And I think one of the things I do in Exodus is look at the small but emerging studies on happiness, migration and happiness, if you like, the psychological side of migration. And it's astonishing because there's that free lunch, tenfold increase in productivity just by getting on a plane. Who captures that? Overwhelmingly, it's the migrants themselves. Right? They're the ones who are doing the work. They earn the money. They capture it. But then you look at, does that make them happier? The answer is, broadly, as far as we can see, no. Because what the happiness studies generally have found is that the main impact on happiness is family and social context. And so the migrants have all this sense of being uprooted, hence all these novels, and the stress of being in a society where you're not rooted, and so you cluster together in these little groups, just like my grandfather did when he got to Bradford, he went to Little Germany. So these psychological stresses broadly offset the big gains from benefits from higher income. So on the whole, the evidence is what happens to happiness, it's a wash.
After all that effort.
After all that effort.
All these novels of this dislocation.
Yes, that's right. We like the novels, so there's something, you know, I'm not saying don't migrate.
Paul Collier talking to Richard Lee. Exodus, Immigration and Multiculturalism in the 21st Century is published by Alan Lane. There's some contentious stuff in there, so do let us know what you think. If you've come to us through iTunes or SoundCloud, you'll find us at theguardian.com/books. Just click on the podcast button at the top of the page. Well, why don't you go a step further and subscribe? The Man Booker Prize will be announced on the evening of Tuesday, October the 15th. We're running video hustings for each of the 6 shortlisted titles, so if you want to size up the competition, do check them out. Our podcast next week is going to be all about letters from Christopher Isherwood to Ernest Hemingway. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead, and producer Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.